pleasure to introduce Juliana from Los Osos. Give her a round of
applause. Hey guys, I'm Juliana and I'm one hell of an alcoholic. Man, what an honor it is to be in this room right now. A lot of faces that are familiar. Some of you guys, I still don't remember your name because, yeah, just because you get sober doesn't mean you get your brain back all the way. But, man, my story, I have many of them, but let's just keep it simple. I'm originally from Louisiana and born and raised with fire, hell, and brimstone. You know, both parents are full-time evangelists. And so I had a double dose of this is the way, the truth, and the life. And don't get me wrong, Jesus is just all right with me. It's each their own. But, you know, I couldn't wait to be 18 to do what I wanted to do. And I stayed imprisoned ever since then until I found sobriety. My story goes, started off, you know, drugs is a part of my story. So for all you purists, I'm sorry. It is an alcoholic meeting, and I will try to keep that in mind. Alcohol definitely is part of it as well. I put heroin, cocaine, and Jack Daniels in a spoon. So, yes, does that make me an alcoholic? Most definitely. I have traded one addiction for the next in the majority of my building my testimony. And that was just so I could relate to everybody, I think, you know. But you know, I moved to Florida to get away from cocaine. That was really smart, and I've made many wise decisions in my journey, and that was the beginning of insanity for me. And I started freebasing cocaine, and drinking was always a part of my story. That's actually how it began. Whenever I was 12, 13 years old, I'd sneak away from church because Mom and Dad were up at the pulpit, and I could steal the keys and go to the liquor store, get bottles of Bartles and James and, you know, whatever I wanted to get my hands on, and stealing and all that fun stuff. And I was a great, great advocate for all the young children in the church. You know, between Ouija boards and drinking, I made my parents very, very proud. And, you know, that's just, you know, a light. I don't want to give you details, but, you know, the fun part about going to try to do these geographical changes, thinking that if I could just go here and get a fresh start, things will be different. And, you know, I know you've heard the saying, you do drink or drug and you break out in handcuffs. You know, that definitely was my story for many years. But I was more so imprisoned in my own mind. So everything that happened to me in a physical world was happening to me emotionally and spiritually as well. And you know, I moved to Florida to get away from crack cocaine, and found real cocaine in Florida, and got involved. You know, I used to think, oh, if I could just get this, then it'll be better. When I just get this part, you know, it'll be better. And you know, I need to meet that person, or I need to get married and have a child, and you know, my life will be better once I achieve these things of success that I thought would bring me happiness. And you know, it took many, many years for me to realize that it is not so much the materialistic things or ideas. You know, I had a faulty belief system for many, many years of thinking of this illusion that once I do this, then my life would get better. I always had a plan and, you know, smart thinker there. And so I moved to Florida. You know, I had two children, and I abandoned them. And this is not a story that I take pride and joy in. You know, I made many, many, many mistakes and took many hostages along the way. But I did cocaine and lost my brain for about 4.5 years. And, I mean, I literally sent my kids away for the summer to their aunt's house, my sister, and she said, why don't you just let them stay with me for a little while? And I thought, woohoo, I'm 23 years old, I don't have my parents on my, you know, I'm divorced, I have no responsibilities. It's the greatest thing ever, and I thought for sure that was going to be the answer. And I completely went insane, and I woke up literally 4 years later. And said, I just need to be closer to my kids. My ex-husband is from Cambria. And so all my journey began is to do a cross-country crime spree to be closer to my kids out here. My story is pretty amazing, and I guess I'll just tell you the story, one that's kind of funny, and it's about midget and motorhomes. And you know, I was in Florida, and before I said I'm done and I'm just going to put down the cocaine and the booze and come out to California, I had two people get one DUI. So let me tell you how the story goes. Let me tell you a little bit about how this life, you know, one of the stories. And so I had a pick. Those of you guys that don't know what a pick is, it's a partner in crime. And his name was Todd. And he was about 4'11", maybe, and on a good day, if he had his lift on his right shoe, and his hair was down the middle of his back, and he was my distraction while I would go in and do the crimes, or, you know, get over on people, or, you know, run them down through it, whatever it was. And so he was a drunk, I was a drunk, and I was in love with this midget. And I just knew that we were going to have this wonderful life together. And it, you know, looks didn't matter. None of that mattered. I loved him for the man he was, and half the man he was. And so, anyway, you know, Todd was very, very crazy, and this is a true story. He, both his parents were from the circus. And father was a daredevil and his mother was a trapeze artist, and both of them had passed away, one of them from alcoholism and the other one on a trapeze, you know, walking the tightrope or whatever, she fell and had an accident. But, you know, Todd was quite an interesting part of my journey, and very hilarious. There should be a sitcom, I'm sure, somewhere. I think there's an episode on Cop somewhere. And we had decided to go down to Bike Week into Daytona, and we had, you know, I'd saved all my SSI money, and went down to Florida, and we decided to buy a motorhome, and it was like a 1976 Dodge, you know, I don't know, the Rambler or something. I don't know, some big motorhome. And it had this huge engine in it, and it was, the paint was peeling off of it. And I said, we'll just spray paint it. And I would spray paint the side of it that says, "Welcome to the jungle." And on the front of it, we spray painted, "Show me your tits." And so we went down to Daytona Bike Week in all of our glory, and I just knew I could fix this motorhome up. You know, I was going to have black lights in it and the Harley Davidson. And to me, you know, isn't it funny, what used to be all right is not all right with us today. You know, I have lifted my vision higher, thank God. But, you know, when you're in a psychosis of such, of drugs and alcohol, we're so blinded to really what our worthiness is. And you know, we were in Bike Week, and we were popping wheelies in this thing, and I was trying to cook a steak in the back, and he was driving with the lift on his shoe, and he's drunk, drunk. And anyway, I want you to vision Todd. Like I said, he was about 4'11" on a good day, and he had hair down the middle of his back, never wore a shirt, looked like an ape from up here, and his legs were about this big. And he never went anywhere without a handle. You know, he always had a gallon of Jack Daniels with him everywhere he went. And I just remember this visualization of Todd, you know, of having this gallon of Jack Daniels, you know, with him that was bigger than him, pretty much. And but he always had this handle, and we were drinking. I had a, you know, this is the fun part of drinking and drugging. You know, we had an ice chest about this big in the middle of this motorhome, and I was wanting a cigarette. Very, very bad. And he was not listening to me. How dare him. And he was popping wheelies with pushing the gas on the thing. And it's back to bumper-to-bumper traffic, you know. And I don't know if you guys have ever been down to Daytona Bike Week, but it is mayhem. And it, I mean, you are, it's worse than L.A. traffic. It's bad. And so he's in this car, and he's popping one of these, and I was like, pull this son of a bitch over. I want to get a cigarette. And he wasn't listening. I said, fine, I'll go get a cigarette myself. So I opened up the back door while we were driving. I jumped out, and I went into 7-Eleven, and I'm watching him. I'm coming out, and I'm packing my cigarettes. And I'm watching him. He pulls into, I guess it's like the Hyatt or some nice hotel, and there is a parking garage on the left and the building to the right, and I swear to God, he pulls in, and the width of the motorhome is too big for this little tiny alleyway. I think it's where trash cans went or something. I don't know what he was thinking, but he pulls in, and he gets stuck. And I'm just packing my cigarettes, watching him, going, this son of a bitch, I gotta watch this. And so he backs out, and when he backs out, he rips the whole wall off the side of the motorhome, backs into somebody's Camaro, runs over that, right, backs in, and turns around, and I'm like, get back here, you know, and it's like, God, let me tell you something, you don't need to get back over here, you know, and I'm screaming, oh, country ass, you know, I mean, classy, in my addiction, and so, we're both drunker than a three-peater billy goat, and those of you guys that don't know what that is, if you're from the South, you might, so, you know, coming, to a realization, this guy is chasing him down the street on foot, saying, you hit my girlfriend's car. And Todd pulls in to come and get me, and he's just, ha, 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 ha. He's just laughing the whole time. He doesn't even speak English. He's just, ha, 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 ha. You know? And I said, don't worry. I'm a psychiatrist. Let me handle this. And so I told the guy that was running out, and the guy thought I was serious. I don't know why. He must have been drunk, too. But anyway, I said, I've got this. Let me handle this. And I said, son, you're going to have to give me the keys. And he goes, oh. And so I push him over, jump in the car, pull it in reverse, and we're off. The guy runs across and sucker punches. Remember, the wall was off on the right-hand side, okay? So he's got a free swing. And he pulls in. He just, you know, decks Todd out. Todd passes out. Still got that gallon of Jack Daniels, you know, on his fingers. You know, he's still holding on to that. And I'm like, if we just get over the bridge and out of this traffic, we'll be safe. Right? And so we make it out of traffic. I don't know how. We made it out of traffic over the bridge, and we're driving. I'm driving along. And he's passed out, you know, no shirt on. He's hanging his head out the door. And I'm like, Todd, wake up, you son of a bitch, you know, and I'm cussing him out. He's ruined my whole day. And messed up my drinking for the day. You know, how dare all this drama happen? Anyway, so all of a sudden, this officer pulls up. Remember, the side of the wall is making sparks on the drive. I mean, it's, you know, sparks are flying, TVs are flying out. I mean, black lights are going, you know, it's bad. I'm trying to paint y'all this visualization here. And so I'm like, maybe if I just don't look at the cop, he won't recognize me. Anyway, so I'm driving, and I look over at the officer, and he's like, pull that piece of shit over. And I'm like, all right, no problem. Like, nothing's wrong. Nothing's out of whack here. And I pull over, and the cop keeps going. I cannot believe that this cop kept driving. And so we pull over, and I'm, Todd, wake up, you know? And so I pick him up. I get out of the car. I've got him over my shoulder. And I am, like, freaking out, thinking, let's just get out of here. Just leave the whole place. Let's go. Mind you, I had warrants and cops after me in the other county, many counties, states. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm trying to get out of this whole picture. And sure enough, the cop pulls back around through the alley, and he's like, uh-uh, you two, get out. And so I drop Todd. He still got the bottle. Not letting go. Death grip on the Jack Daniels. And I said, you know, you got me. Todd says, "You got me. I'm drunk, drunk as a skunk." And so, of course, I gave him an alias, and, you know, Todd couldn't even speak. So, you know, like I said, I'm sure that's an episode on Cops somewhere. And but they charged us both with DUI, you know. So that's how two people get a DUI. You just switch driver seats, and you cause a lot of mayhem, and you can get that. So that was the beginning of my legal fun stuff. And of course I went in underneath an alias and went back to doing what I knew to do. And mind you, you know, I'd always go to jail just for these brief moments, you know, 10 days here, 15 days there. And in Florida, they release you on probation. If you're on probation, you still have a bail. Well, that was their fault. They should have never done that, because I must have done that 15, 20 times. And then one day I put down the bottle and put down the pipe, and I said, you know, I'm going to go to California. I just need to be closer to my children. I'm done with this stuff. This time it's going to be different. And so I took my stolen Cadillac, and I brought Todd with me, and we off on our journey. You know, I kept saying, whenever I get this much dope and this much, you know, money, then I'll have what I need. And so this has been the illusion of my journey for many, many years. For 10 years after that, if once I get this, then I'll be okay. And so, you know, off we went and across country, and we made it here. And within 3 months, you know, I said, let me do this one more bank scam, and then I'll be set. And, you know, lying, stealing, cheating, corrupt, all of those fun character defects come out, you know, whenever we're drinking and using. And needless to say, California is a different place. You know, they're not like Florida. They're kind of up on their game here. They're a little bit further along in their judicial system, should I say. So I didn't have much skills here. In Florida, I was a genius. But here, you know, it wasn't going too far. So within 3 months, I got arrested in Morro Bay. I had my children with me. And because I was thinking, if I just smoke pot whenever I get out here, if I just do the weed maintenance, I'll be okay. You know, and nothing's wrong with smoking pot. I'm going to smoke pot till the day I die. And so I'm thinking I'm just going to do that, but I was addicted also to the lifestyle of making that quick money, you know. So you take one thing for the other. You know, it really doesn't matter what drug or mind-altering substance it is. You know, I always switched one for the other. That's part of my story. And, you know, needless to say, you know, I went to jail under Jane Doe. They found all these wonderful 24 IDs with my pictures on them, and ID machines and credit card machines. And I was doing identity theft before identity theft was a crime, and or before they had a name for it. So luckily, I only went to prison for 2 years for receiving stolen property. I love AA because it's the only place that you can be completely naked and say, yeah, you know, I went to prison, I did this, and da-da-da, and all you guys are like, yeah, I understand that. So it's like where your weaknesses, you know, or things that have gone bad in your life can be used for your strength. So that's why I love this place. No judgment, right? So started my journey and going to prison, and I thought, I will never come back here again. And as horrible as that was, is going to prison, it was also one of the best experiences that I could have ever had. I learned a lot, but obviously not enough, because I decided to continue doing life on the installment program. It got easier for me to go back and forth to prison, and I did that for about 8 years. September, and my disease continued to progress. You know, every time that I would have a little bit of sobriety underneath my belt, I would get out and say, this time it's going to be different. I always had the greatest intentions. You know, this time I'll just do this. And it says that in the big book. You know, if I only drink after 5 o'clock, if I try this, you know, buy a boat, don't buy a boat. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's like, we are going to figure this thing out. I'm going to figure this thing out. And so it, to say I'm hard-headed is an understatement. And so 8 years of my life, I was in and out of prisons, jails, institutions, death. And I got to experience all of those. And I'm not dead today. as if y'all didn't know that. But, so I did die. I was clinically pronounced dead, and I'm not talking about OD'ing. I mean, I should not be able to formulate a sentence. And it was actually in lovely Santa Maria that, at the Dirty Dive of a hotel, can't remember the name of it. But, you know, I had gotten out of prison and thinking, just let me see the love of my life, and it'll be, and then whenever I do that, and then I'll go back and do my time. I'd gotten out on a technicality or something, so I knew I was going to go back, and I wasn't going to do drugs, I wasn't going to drink. I just need to see, you know, this person that meant so much to me, this relationship. And I knew that I was going to be, talk about relationships, you know. They are as addicting as drugs and alcohol, and they can take you further than you want to go and keep you longer than you want to stay. And really, really twisted thinking. And I was going to be with this woman like I knew I was the mother of my children is how I knew to the degree that I was not going to be separated from this woman. And it was such a soul tie that we had together, but it was gasoline and fire. And it was all fantasy based, and it was wonderful, it was exciting, it was great, it was toxic, it was deadly. And so September 15th of 2006, I woke up in my little Dirty Dive of a hotel and said, let me do one more fix, my Jack Daniels, my heroin, and mix that up in a spoon, and that was the last thing I remember. I did wake up at Marion Medical Center, handcuffed to a bed after two vials of Narcan and being put in the hospital for a few days on life support and going through that. You know, the officer that was there was a rookie, and he was watching me, and he says, have you ever seen Pulp Fiction? That was you. Man, I swear to God, that was you. I saw you whenever I went in there. There was no way. You were DOA whenever I came in there. No way you're awake right now. I mean, I, like, changed his life. I mean, I thought he was high. I mean, he was so, like, freaked out. He just knew I was the girl off of Pulp Fiction. And so, you know, I was so clouded, you know, in everything. Like, I didn't even know what my name was. There was obviously some brain damage, and still is, I'm sure. You know, but, I mean, there was, and then I got to recover in lovely Santa Barbara Jail. Some of you guys know about that place. And in Santa Barbara County Jail, there was a program called STP. Any of you guys familiar with STP? Okay, so Chuck McLean was part of that whole endeavor there, and you know, I was looking at 8 years prison consecutive and term, and I'd always slipped in and out of the system pretty easily, you know, whether it was from in Florida, it was high-paid attorneys, and then, you know, I remember running with the cartel in Florida, and then I got arrested for stealing butter here in, you know, San Luis County. So, you know, our disease takes us further than we want to go and keeps us longer than you want to stay. And the judge, I'll never forget going from the judge, you know, after that two-year little spree that I did in Chowchilla, and he says, you were here originally for embezzlement, and you're here today for a misdemeanor, which is a felony because you've had so many consecutive petty thefts. But am I reading this correct? Are you here for stealing butter? And I'm yes, I'm here for stealing butter. So they gave me a 16-month term for stealing butter. And so off I went again. But, you know, after that OD in September, and going back and thinking that I just need to do this or I just need to do that, all I know is that I had no more ideas. Like, I had tried every human imaginable remedy, you know, to get my life together, and there was a realization that came to me that I didn't know what to do. And that was life-changing for me, especially Miss Know-It-All, you know, because I was so smart in my past. But, you know, I mean, there was something that shifted for me. And I, like I said, I was looking at 8 years prison, and I kept going to court trying to get a speedy trial. And It's like nobody, it's like I was invisible. Nobody was paying attention to me. You know, nobody cared. And they're like, oh, we'll just dismiss you. We'll put you on off for another month or another 2 weeks or another this. That went on for 8 months in the county jail. And I kind of walked around like a zombie for about 4 of those months in the county jail. And Chuck McLean would come, and they put me in STP. I'm like, why are you putting me in STP? You know, this is not my first rodeo. And matter of fact, you know, whenever I first got clean and sober, introduced to 12 steps, it was in this room here. So it's an honor to be here with you guys. And I went to ASA. And knew Malcolm and Jim and some more very familiar faces, Billy. You know, this is where it really screwed up my drinking and using. So if you guys don't get it for the newcomers, know you are totally fucked next time you go by to drink and use. Spoonful of this and a little bit of AA, doesn't mix. Anyway, so, you know, Chuck McLean spoke to me, and there was something that penetrated my spirit. And I knew that I knew nothing. And it was one alcoholic talking to another where it began. And he just said, I need you just to let me love you until you can learn to love yourself. You know, and I said, what does that look like? You know, what does that mean? And he said, just, you need to trust the process. Yeah, right. Okay, trust the process, because it's gone so well for me before. And, you know, I had no idea what that meant. And I was just ready to go to prison. And I had made a deal with God, because I've made so many with him. And I said, you know, if my destiny is to go back to prison, because I had done that for 8 years, in and out, in and out, in and out, and here I was looking at another 8. I had failed as a mother, I had failed as a wife, I had failed as a daughter, as a sister. You know, I had betrayed everyone that I'd loved and taken many, many people hostage with me and ruined many, many lives, including my own. And let me tell you something. God had a different plan for me, and I had no idea what it was, and I did not come into back into the rooms with like, woohoo, let's do recovery. I mean, it was like, I don't know how to explain it, except I just did what I was told. You know, I pretty much was robotic. But the chances of me getting out of prison was a miracle in itself. I remember going in front of the parole board because I had a violation on top of new charges on top of you know, and the parole board saying, you know, little lady, you don't need prison, you need rehab. And I was just like, okay, that's a miracle, because I knew that they were going to say, I mean, I had violated many, many violations, and that was a miracle in itself. So they sent me back to county. You know, I was never left county. They sent me back to my cell, and in that 8-month course, kept trying to get my court stuff like wrapped up so we could get, just let me know something so I could come into acceptance of it, you know. And they kept putting me off and putting me off and putting me off and putting me off. And I had decided quietly that if I went back to prison, I was going to kill myself. I couldn't do it in county jail. And obviously, I don't know what made me think that, because I couldn't even do it right whenever I tried out in the real world. But, you know, I had decided that I was not going to spend the next 8 years in prison. And I knew how to do prison, but I was done. And I really wanted to kill myself, and that was the point that I was at. And I said, and if I am to get out, then I know that it's something bigger than me that has a different plan, and I'll just follow direction. I'll just do it for a year. And I tell you what, whenever I made that conscious arrangement with my spirit, God, whatever it may be, something shifted. And the doors were open up to the system. They let me out, and of course it was 18 months dual diagnosis court, 1 year Judge Flores. You know, you need to do a year program and 6 months aftercare and da 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 da. It was like 5 years of like parole, probation. I mean, it was like everything. And anybody that's been in the system knows that that's just a setup, you know. And so I didn't have an opinion anymore. It's the only thing that I could say. You know, I didn't really know what to expect. But I do know that on the day that they released me, Chuck McClain, they put me in a holding cell to be released. And I just got in fetal position and began to cry because I was so scared of failure, fear of failure, fear of success, fear of the unknown. And I literally was in fetal position, and this gigantic man, you know, Chuck, came up and scooped me up physically and picked me up, and he says, come on, I'm going to take you into treatment. And I just knew I was going to screw it up, and sure enough, I did. But I didn't use, and I didn't drink. Those are the only two things that I did right, you know, and they put a lesbian in a Christian home for a one-year residential treatment center. You know, I like to say, even still to today, that was not a wise decision, but truth is that I didn't know how to follow direction. Truth is that I didn't know how to follow rules. And I had forgotten that I had made a commitment to myself and to my God and to Chuck. Right? That I was going to do this thing for 1 year. I was just going to follow direction. If you had told me to put a tutu on and dance down Main Street, I was going to do it. You know, I mean, it's like whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. But we have the disease of forgetfulness. You know, along with the disease of alcoholism, we have the disease of forgetfulness. So, you know, many of us forget what our promise is or what our commitment is or what our vision is. And so in order to be reminded of that, we have to be irritable, discontent, and a little crazy in our own juices, you know, before we realize that, oh, yeah, I forgot, I'm surrendering that. That's what I'm doing. I'm surrendering that, you know. And it was a hard, hard journey. But let me tell you something. You know, I got kicked out of that treatment center for bringing in an R-rated movie, not following directions. Doesn't matter, stealing butter, doesn't matter, you know. I didn't follow the rules. I never didn't play well with others. I mean, it's just something I never was able really to do. And so I got kicked out of that, and immediately I wanted to run. That's what I knew to do. All right, well, fine, I'll just go steal a U-Haul, and I'll go to Louisiana. That's what I'll do. I'll hide out in the truck, you know, and here comes that good thinking of mine, you know. And I went, oh, yeah. I tried that. That didn't work. Shit, I can't do that. I tried that. That didn't work. And so all these scenarios and great brainstorms of ideas that make sense to every alcoholic and addict when they're in the midst of their greatest fears, that moment of clarity, you know, started coming to me. And I just realized, oh, yeah, I've tried all that, and that doesn't work. So what do I do? Why don't you do what you were told to do? Oh, yeah, pick up the phone. Shit. Okay, I'll pick up the phone. Because in the moments that I wasn't important enough to make decisions for me, which didn't come till much later, that person, for me, it was Chuck McClain. For me, it was, you know, those people that stuck their necks out, that was one alcoholic and talking to another, that believed in me when I couldn't believe in myself. And I said, well, screw me, but I can't do this to Chuck, you know? And so people say, oh, you have to do this for yourself. Bullshit. You do it for whoever keeps you in that moment, you know? If it's your kid, great. If it's your husband, great. If it's the doorknob, great. Whatever it is, utilize whatever it is for you to sit on your hands and not run. And so, and for that, I am extremely grateful. So I picked up the phone and I asked for direction. And Mindy showed up, which is now my wife, and I still broke rules. You know, I got into a relationship whenever I shouldn't have. I screwed up, you know, according to all the highly suggestions, they called them, in AA. I broke many rules, and I'm a rule breaker, you know, but I don't drink and I don't get loaded no matter what. Those are the things that I don't do. You know, Mindy showed up because she had a car. She was convenient. She showed up. It was great. She was a good friend. And I said, come get me. And she was there. And then we called Chuck, and Chuck said, go to the sober living, go right now, they'll pass go, da, 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 da. I said, I don't have any money, I just paid all my, he said, I don't care, go, this is what you're going to do. He called me back within 24 hours. I called him back, you know, and it was like touch and go crisis center. He's like, I want you to go to Casa Serena in Santa Barbara. I said, I don't have money for Casa Serena. He says, I want you to go to the, just do what I'm telling you to do. Okay, so I went there, and they accepted me, and, you know, probation said they were going to violate me for getting kicked out of this other place. And, I mean, so my story is one of continuous screw-ups, you know. I mean, I continuously tried to self-sabotage. I, you know, character defects get in the way of just doing what the hell you're supposed to be doing. You know, put one foot in front of the other, call some people that know more than you, and follow direction. And so for a year, I followed direction, and it was amazing. Within 3 months, you know, you have to have a job when you go to CASA or volunteer or do something like that. And, of course, they don't ask on an employee application, have you been, you know, convicted of 10 or less convictions. It's just one, you know. So, I mean, it's not like. So I was nervous as could be, and I went to go fill out an application, and I would have scrubbed toilets. I was very, very humble, and this was about 6 months into my recovery, and I was very, very humble and said, you know, I would scrub a toilet. I'll do whatever I need to do and do it gratefully. And so I went in, and on this application as a hostess for a place in Santa Barbara, they did not ask, have you been convicted? And I thought, score, I don't have to lie, I don't have to do nothing, it's right here, yay, okay, and then I'll just charm them, and yeah, mm-hmm, and I'll get this little $8 an hour job. And so I went there, and I said, any chance of me waiting tables? He said, oh no, these people are older than dirt that have been here, you know, they're waiting tables, that's not going to happen. I said, okay, all right, fine, I'll hostess, that's great with me. Well, within 2 weeks, I said, would you like to start busing and waiting tables? I said, okay. And at this rehab at Casa Serena, I had to be in by 5 p.m., so I just told them I had education, you know. I had a prior commitment at 5, so they worked out my hours accordingly. I had to learn the whole wine list, you know. Pinot Grigio, whatever fuck hell, I don't know. Anyway, I had to learn all of that Pinot. And so, you know, that never bothered me, you know. So I learned everything I needed to learn for the waitressing position. And then in about, I guess it was about 2 or 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from the back office. And I was always told, don't ever bother those women in the back office. You know, it was kind of like the principal's office. Like, you never go back there. And there were just these little fat ladies that were always working in the back. And I just kept my ground, do what I was supposed to do, keep a low profile, which is hard for me to begin with. And so, you know, I did what I was supposed to be doing. And then they called me and said, we need to talk to you in the back office. And I thought, oh, shit. They found out who I am. They find out I'm handling people's credit cards. They're going to fire me, you know. And, of course, immediately we think the worst. So I'm not going to call them. Mindy says, just call them. And I'm like, no, I don't want to call them, man. I don't want to know. I'll just go back to work and do my shift. And I'm just like, you're going to have to call them. And so I went in and saw them. I had my little apron on, and I was waiting tables. I'm like, how can I help you? And they're like, listen, we were looking over your application and your resume. And I'm thinking, resume? They never filled out a resume. And they're like, we want to know, do you count cash? And I went, yeah. They were like, do you know anything about payroll? And I was thinking, oh, yeah. I ran my own many years. And so, you know, what about banking? And I was like, oh, shit, here it comes. Anyway, so I just knew that they had my number. And they said, we would like to offer you a full-time position in our accounting office as an accounting manager, and we want to put you, you know, as far as our assistant here. We'd like to start you out at $45,000 a year and give you insurance. We'll start today. Are you interested? It's from 9 to 5 every day. to say that was so surreal. I couldn't believe it, you know. And then within like 2 weeks, they gave me their codes to their restaurant. It wasn't just that restaurant. It was six major restaurants that I was in charge of their payroll. Scary as hell, you know, to put me in a position. But I think I've never been given an opportunity to be trusted at such a high level. And you know, I just realized my higher power had such a sense of humor, you know, as far as making a living amends, is that I get to make sure that the books are in order. You know, I get to experience this. And that was an amazing job that I had and got to grow in and got to learn some things. And I did not screw them over. For the first time in my life, I did not screw somebody else over. And it meant everything to me. And I think that my higher power knew that I needed these promises quicker, you know, sometimes sooner, sometimes later. I think that it was imperative for me to see, you know, now. I don't know why, but I tell you, as I stayed sober and put one foot in front of the other and asked for directions, my life began to unfold dramatically, and it continues to. And so, just to tell you a little bit, that's how it was and how it is today is through AA, through following the 12 steps, through following the direction of people that are wiser, older, smarter, you know, that my companions are not lower companions today. My companions, I try to surround myself around people that are smarter, prettier, and richer than I am, you know, because I want what they have. I want to be smarter. I want to be prettier. I want to be richer. I want to be more spirit-filled, you know. And so that's what I get from finding in the relationships of AA and that my desires, you know, my vision is lifted so much, and what used to be okay is not okay today. You know, finding that bus, you know, and wanting to deck it out, you know, and thinking, oh man, if I could just get that storage system right there, I could live in that and that'd be all right. You know, today, it's mandatory for me to have running water. It's mandatory for me to have electric bills that are paid. You know, those are things that just come. So to the good stuff. The promises that are given are just absolutely amazing. I am here to testify to you that recovery does work. I was a hope-to-die dope fiend, alcoholic, that could not get it right. Everybody had given up on me. Everyone, except you. So, the countless prayers that my mother and father continued to put up for me were not in vain. You know, everything has been restored to me a hundredfold. And let me tell you a little bit about what the promises have done for me, what promises those are. You know, not only did I get that little job and I had to do interferon, I had hep C and I went through that, but I left that job in good standing. I actually had a good, you know, thing I could put on my next job application is that, you know, a good reference. And that made me feel good. And the more good I did, the more better I felt about who I was. And I continue to do that. And what feeds my spirit is working with the newcomer. And so I decided to go to school and actually complete something. And because I'd been through probably 10 different colleges and never completed a damn thing. And I said, you know, I don't want to be a drug and alcohol counselor, but, you know, let me go in and do this. And whereas I was always the one that felt left out and isolated in my school years, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and having the foundation set for me, I was able to go to school, complete it, be the A student, you know. I had study guides and groups and people, and we stuck together, and now those people are coworkers of mine and people that I look up to that are doing this thing. And so I got my KDAC drug and alcohol license, and then moved on. Life began to unfold. And remember, I had abandoned my children at not even a year out of sobriety, their father said, here, take them. And, you know, my whole life I'd been fighting to try and get them, and being in and out of their lives, being in a broken relationship as a mother for them. I was never able to be there for them. And when they were 14 and 16, or 13 and 15, they came back into our lives and have been with us ever since. Can't get them to leave. No. But, you know, they really have come back, and those relationships have been restored. I have an amazing relationship with both of my children. But remember whenever I said that I abandoned my children when they were young, from like 2 to 10, you know, pretty much. I had pretty much, I woke up in the morning thinking about my next drink or drug, not about my children. So that didn't come natural for me. And I felt shame and guilt from that. And making those amends and trying to do the next right indicated thing, God put into our lives an amazing little boy that at the age of 18 months old, he came into our lives, was dropped off at our doorstep. I used to get loaded with his mother. I was 12-stepping his mother at the county jail, and the baby was MIA. Crazy story. I could write a book, but, you know, he was living in a car with a tweaker dad, and I knew the mom and dad from my running days, and she said, I want you to try and find my baby. She was going to prison. And so we adopted, we have custody of this little boy, and he's 18 months old. At 20 months, we found out that he had cancer in his right femur, and we went through hell and high water with that. And remarkably, he got through the cancer and every, you know, and is completely healed. And you would never think for a million years that he had any disability at all. But those moments that I missed with my children, I got to now have with this little boy. And those of you guys that are mothers that have missed those points, you know, I never had that natural mother instinct. I never, yeah. They were more of a hassle, you know, than a beautiful thing. And Jason is his name, and he just turned 7. And, you know, his mother is building her testimony. His biological mother is doing whatever she needs to be doing on her journey, but we're doing what we need to be doing as far as taking care of this little boy. He is ours. He's not going anywhere. And he is amazing. And so all those things, as far as that guilt and shame of not being there as a mother for my children, was restored back to me in that aspect of being able to be that mother for this little boy. I opened up my own business. I decided to open up an STP out at the county jail in San Luis. I tried that for a couple of months, and I said, let me just volunteer my time and show you guys what I'm doing, and I wanted to do what Chuck was doing. And so I brought the message out to jails and institutions and volunteered my time for 6 months. They decided, of course, to go in-house. This is before AB 109 and all the laws were into effect. And I said, fine, I have to draw my boundaries because I have to get paid. And I was introduced to a medical doctor that is an addiction specialist. And today, I am clinical director of an intensive outpatient program. Mindy and I have opened up House of Serenity, which is a sober living for women. To think that if you had told me 10 years ago that this is what I was going to be doing, I would have laughed at you and gone about smoking my dope, you know, and drinking my booze. I mean, yeah, who's loaded now? You know, but I mean, guys, the promises are so damn real and so good. You'd be an idiot not to sit on your hands and expect for them to happen. I'm telling you, if you put one foot in front of the other, try the recipe, you'll get the cake. I mean, and I know this is like, everybody says this, you know, if I can do it, you can do it. But really, that's the clean version of my story. You know? That's just the pieces I want to remember. I mean, I have pieces of the story that are dark and grim, you know. Nobody in this room is hopeless. If you were, you wouldn't be here. You have an opportunity to be a victor. You are no longer a victim, right? So take pride in what you have. Learn from somebody else that has something more than you. Lift your vision higher. You have the ability to be restored. You are worthy of your recovery. I tell myself that every morning. Do I follow it to a T? Hell no. You know, I mean, I fight every addiction possible. It's not just drinking and drugging. It's food. If it's not food, then it's, you know, I mean, exercise. I mean, anything that's good for me, I want to discount. And I still fight that battle, you know. I want you to center yourself right now. I'm like, yeah, miss me with that, you know. Tell yourself you love you every day in the mirror. I'm like, yeah, right, you know. I look in the mirror and I see that I weigh 350 pounds, you know. I mean, nothing, it's that faulty belief system that you are not good enough, that you're not enough. I still battle that today. But the one thing that I do is that I try to help the newcomer out. I live true to the 12 steps. It's a part of who I am today. That old person is no longer who I am today. I mean, it just seems like some book that I read, you know. I mean, it's not even that it's that long ago, but I mean, it's so foreign to me. I don't attract that lower companion, no pun intended, Todd. But I mean, you know, I don't attract that. And by the way, Todd's doing 25 to 30 years, you know, and in a wheelchair. I mean, you know, I am so lucky to have a seat in this recovery. I wake up with an attitude of gratitude. All I know is that today I want to live more than I want to die, and for me that is a absolute miracle, because the majority of my life I wanted to escape. I wanted to leave. I didn't want to be here. I hated myself. I hated my family. I hated you. I hated everyone around me. And the only way to live with myself was to numb myself. That is not an option today. I get to sit through the discomfort. Life is in session. Life hands us a bowl of shit, you know? I mean, whether you're sober or not, it's going to come through it. It's just you learn how to process it. It's how we do things differently. Being a heroin addict, for as long as I was a heroin addict, I just got to do a shot and escape. Today, I kind of switch that perception around. I get to sit in it. Oh, this is what hell feels like. This is what grief feels like. You know, I'm tired of burying people left and right in this disease that aren't fortunate enough to get it. You're fortunate enough tonight to be here, to hear a story, to hear hope, and to take it as your own. You all are worthy of your recovery. Thank you for tonight.
Give Juliana another round of applause.